It's a pleasure to be back with you. It's been quite an adventure since we saw each other last. And it's great to be back from Israel. We see that David and Maria are also back. They're not with us today as they're recovering. And Paula and Crystal are also here. Where are you all at? If you could wave. They've got stories to tell as well, so you could talk to them. I brought two things back from Israel. A shofar. And what might be a Greek or Roman god, I'm not exactly sure, but it appears as though I swallowed it. It's half horse and half frog. So if you can bear with that, bear with me today, and the voice, I'll give you all I've got. I didn't want to miss today. Didn't want to miss this opportunity to look at the events that are occurring in the Middle East that took shape, sudden shape, last Sabbath, the holy day, and look through the biblical lens here and try to do it in as timely a manner as possible. It was last week at this time in the morning, although 10 hours ahead, early morning, we were getting up and getting going and starting to head down to breakfast, and I heard sirens in the hotel, which isn't unusual, and if you've traveled, you know that sirens in different countries sound a little different for an ambulance, and so it didn't really strike me as anything overly concerning. I remember I parted the drapes and looked out the window and didn't see an ambulance go by or anything, but as I then walked down the hall to breakfast, I saw that in the lobby, they were immediately clearing the lobby, and they had already set up a room downstairs for us. The 180-ish that were there for the feast were in a different room than we had been in the past for the dining hall. That was on the lobby floor, but they had a separate lobby or a separate dining hall and place for us to meet for services, which was already underground and in an area that they considered safe. So it really didn't impact us a lot that morning. We were able to have breakfast down there. The safe zone was in the stairwell and in the building core and where we were. So actually where we would have services, if out behind this hall was about this size, that would have been also a safe zone. So there are a lot of other occupants of the hotel that were all down there huddling up in the safe zone. So it was, it didn't impact us immediately, and I think we didn't fully understand the magnitude of what was occurring. And if we consider that we were in a state of Israel or a nation the size of New Jersey that has 10 million in population, the United States is almost 40 times the size of that. And when we look at the citizens that are impacted, either killed or injured, it's bigger than our 9/11 as far as injuries and deaths. And when you multiply it times 40, you can imagine what that impact would feel like if that were to occur here in the United States. So this was the sort of the crescendo to a week worth of time of being immersed in the culture, looking at historical biblical sites. And then on the bus, we would ask questions about the current geopolitical climate. And so we heard about all of these different elements that we're going to talk about today, and we came to then see how they can start to play out. So on trumpets, we were all together, and we were encouraged to pay attention and to watch, and we know that God is and does on an annual basis, and especially this year, draw our attention to his plan and what he's orchestrating on this earth. And so the call was to simu lev then, which is to pay attention and give our hearts to this. And I did want to share that I heard Simu Lev when we were in Israel, and I didn't hear it in the airport, but I don't think I had my ears tuned at first. It seems like everything that we say about these places and names in the Bible, we say completely wrong. And for example, many times you hear a word that you know, but you don't know it's a word that you know. So, Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim. That's Jerusalem, you guys. And so, many times that would happen. So, I did hear Simulev, and the first time I heard it was in Hezekiah's tunnel. So, we're walking in shin-deep water in a little tunnel and ducked down, and there was a place where it got even lower. And so, one of the Israeli groups, it was actually behind us because we had gone through it, and then I heard someone say, Simulev, Simulev, and then something in Hebrew saying that the watch your head, basically. So, and then on the way back, I heard it many times in the airport as they would start an announcement. So now we have a very real application, and we'd like to dive into this. On the Sabbath, before we all left to the feast, we took some time to talk about the importance and impact of Jerusalem in particular and overall Israel as a past, present, and future, and the past, present, and future implications to us as God's people and to the world. And I'll call it a fairly thin sandwich because we really did take some time to dive into the past and Mount Moriah, and then we talked about New Jerusalem in the future, but not a lot in the current. And today, we're going to put some meat in that sandwich and talk about what's going on in the current. So, here we see Israel today. And you see Israel, and we'll talk a little bit about this more. You see the Gaza Strip as you, let's see if this guy's working. Gaza Strip is this little section right here. So you can see that. And then this is the West Bank. The West Bank is on the east side of Israel. It's the west bank of the Jordan. The Jordan River forms the, where do we go here? That forms the eastern border of Israel, between Jordan and Israel. And so this whole area from Sea of Galilee down is the, well, it stops at the Dead Sea. But that's the Jordan River, and that's the border. And then up here is an area called the Golan Heights. And we can talk about the significance of the Golan Heights as well. And we'll take a lot more time to dive into this in future messages. We'll probably have a Bible study after church where we can have church services. And then we can just take some time to go through some slides and really dive into this in more detail. So we see Israel today, and then we'll go to Israel relative to the Middle East. So there's a lot of different groups here represented, and all of them are worthy of further discussion. But what we've got here is an interesting cocktail of emotions. Has anybody ever heard of a Molotov cocktail? Right, an explosive fuel, some sort of fuel in a bottle and all that. We've got a Molotov cocktail here of identity, nationalism, pride associated with this, religion, and their historical roots and historical conflicts that sort of fuel this agitation that's in the Middle West, Middle East. And it really goes back to an ancient conflict that we can understand in the biblical context as we turn to Genesis. This story starts very early in Genesis, and you know that Genesis 12, we first hear of Abraham or Abram at the time, and this calling and these blessings that he was going to be given. And then let's pick up the story here in Genesis 15. So after these things, this blessing and these events that had just occurred, where Abram went to capture Lot, or Lot had been captured, he went and rescued him. So after these things in chapter 15 of Genesis, verse 1, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not be afraid, I am your shield, I am your exceedingly great reward. And he says, but wait a minute, how can this be? I don't even have a son, I don't have an heir. And so God makes a promise to him, and he says, you're going to have an heir. And so in verse 18, he makes this promise. He says, to your descendants, I've given this land from the river Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of all these people, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Cabanites, the Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. You might remember that David bought the threshing floor of Mount Moriah from a Jebusite. So that was the city of Jebus was Jerusalem at the time. So this whole area of Canaan, which, by the way, this area that we're seeing here, the state of Israel, is the land that was referred to as Canaan at one time. So he says, I'm going to give you this land. And he also lists who was occupying that land at the time. So obviously they're not going to be happy about this at some point. And so then we hear read from chapter 16 on the birth of Ishmael. So there's a little human intervention here as Abraham and Sarah are trying to figure out how they get this heir. And this breeds some tension here. And we read something that's really important, instructive, and helps us give some context here. So Sarah and Hagar have, after Sarah says, Abram, go into my handmaid Hagar, and maybe she'll give you an heir, which happens. But then there's a strife between Sarah and Hagar, and so Sarah deals harshly with her. And then in verse 9, after Hagar flees, then the angel of the Lord says to Hagar, return to your mistress, Sarah, and submit under her hand. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they shall not be counted for multitude. This is Ishmael that's being talked about here. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He will be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all of his brethren. This has massive implications here. First of all, it says he will be a wild man or a wild animal. And some translations say a wild donkey of a man. And that sounds like it could be a slight. And when we refer to somebody in that context using different vernacular, it's not a compliment. But in this case, it is. If you think about all the desert animals, the donkey was the king of all the desert animals. Now, of course, there are other wild animals as well, but for the purposes here, it's saying this was a prized animal. So to have a donkey was, well, one, you see them in the wild, they're always well fed, they find a way to get food, they find a way to get water, they defend themselves very well, and it's a prized animal. And then they can be domesticated and do tremendous amounts of work. Just a side note, we were on the bus one day, and just kind of keeping an eye out on both sides to see what's going on out there. And we saw a herd of goats. And then we saw the goat herds. And then it was a little ways away, and I wasn't exactly sure if this is what I saw or not, but this guy jumped on a donkey, and it started bucking and kicking and turning around. And I said to another guy, I said, did I just see that right? He says, yeah, it looks like he's trying to break that donkey. So he was either found or the donkey got to the age where it was time to be broke, and so they were having a good time with this. So Ishmael was going to be a choice man, and that's what we have to read from this, is take away the fact that he is going to be a man that is prized. And so we can see as this goes on, this story goes on, that while he was going to certainly receive certain blessings, that the main blessing was going to go to Isaac. And so we can kind of continue the story. And in Genesis 17, verse 19, we can pick up the story again. So Abraham is wondering if his heir was going to be Isaac, and he's being told, no, Sarah is going to have a son. And so in verse 19, he says, no, God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I've blessed him, And I will make him a fruitful nation and will multiply him exceedingly. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year. And so we're recognizing here that this is the way God ordained it to be. And so it may not make sense. Ishmael technically was the firstborn. So this is a juxtaposition of the normal order of the blessings. And yet this is also the way God does things. And he does what he wants, ultimately. And so we see this with Ishmael, and we see it again one generation later as we turn over to Genesis 36. In Genesis 36, we read about Esau. Now, Esau was one generation later with Jacob and Esau was technically the firstborn, and yet Jacob got the birthright, and we know and have read that story in the past. Now, in chapter 36 here, we read about Esau's descendants. So this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. So the Edomites that we read about in different biblical stories, which is now part of Jordan, is Esau. Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan, so this region that's now called Palestinia. And he took Elon, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and he took Basemath, the Ishmael's daughter. So there's this interweaving here, just one generation later. And if we go back to Genesis 25, I'd like to read something that may have escaped your attention, or maybe it's something you've read before, but we can certainly read about this and understand some context here. How many sons did Abraham, Isaac, Jacob have? Jacob's name was turned to Israel. How many? 12? That sound familiar? 12 tribes of Israel? 12 sons that became the head of 12 tribes, Judah being the most prominent now. The Jews are of Judah. So we come to understand where that's from. How many sons did Ishmael have? 12. We read about this in Genesis 25, verse 12. Now this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, so Ishmael was from Abraham and half Egyptian. This starts to make sense to us as we see the whole context here. And these were the names of the son. And I won't go through them, but there were 12. So Ishmael had these 12 sons, and they all became chiefs of 12 tribes as well. And they populated this area here. So, and then one generation later, we see this intermarrying with Ishmael's daughter and Esau. So the sons of Ishmael and Esau, and then by the way, there's a whole list of Esau's sons as well that became the chiefs of tribes that expanded throughout the Middle East. And so if we look at the Arab nations today, this is a there's a group called the Arab League, and this is the Arab League. And so the Middle East is here to your right, and yet we see a lot of African countries as well. So actually 55% of what we would term Arabs don't even live on the Arabian, whoops, what did we do here? Don't look, just kidding. Okay, so this is the Arabian Peninsula here. We all see that. So Saudi Arabia. So that's where we get the term Arab from, Arabian Peninsula. But it refers to a much, much broader group of people, and it's really speaking to their common lineage, and we're reading about that lineage now. And so Egypt, you can see here in the northeast part of Africa, and Algeria, Libya, and Sudan, this is where the Arabs live. So it's 55-45. And then there are cousins as well. It gets kind of small here up in Jordan, but that's where the land of the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, do we remember these? Edom is Esau, Ammon and Moab are from Lot's descendants, and so we see this all coming together here. Now, what is Palestine? So let's talk about Palestine here. So geographically, we're now looking at Israel again, and these colors aren't as contrasting enough, but I think you'll be able to see with a little help here, the pointer. The geography of what is termed Palestine is the modern-day nation of Israel. It's the biblical land of Canaan, and it's other words of it, other names for it are the Promised Land, or the Holy Land, or the Land of Israel. And it was renamed Palestine. Actually, the Palestine comes from Philistine, and we can see how that comes together. And I'll read this for you. Prior to the mid-20th century, the term Palestine was used as a regional term, much like referring to the residents of parts of the United States as Southerners. So the usage dates back several centuries before Christ. The word Palestine has its roots in a Hebrew word meaning Philistine. Until Israel was reestablished as a nation in 1948, Palestine was the term for the territory between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, which we've already talked about where that is. The word Palestinian was applied to anyone living in that area. One of the longest continually inhabited places on earth, this region has changed political ownership numerous times and has been the nexus of a migration for many different cultures. The modern-day Palestinians represent a mixture of local inhabitants and many other groups of Muslims brought from Bosnia, the Balkans, Caucasus, by the Turks. And so it's this mix. And also from the Sudan, Egypt, Syria, and Lebanon. So all Arabic territories. The term Palestinian did not take on its current popular meaning until the mid-20th century. In common use today, the term Palestinian is primarily applied to non-Jewish, Arabic-speaking residents of this region. The usage is highly controversial, however, since for most of human history, a Palestinian was simply a person born or living in that land. When used in reference to only non-Jews, it implies a historical claim to the territory in opposition to Israel. In reality, the concept of Palestine as a nation-state in opposition to Israel or as a racial group predating the presence of Jewish inhabitants is historically false because we know that God has given this land to them. And then it goes in to describe that recent genetic studies confirm that the ancestries of Jewish and Arabic inhabitants of Palestine are extremely similar. So as we let that sink in, why would their DNA be extremely similar? Well, they have common ancestry. They go back to Abraham and then Ishmael, Isaac, Esau again. So they're closely related. They know this, by the way. This is not lost on them. So these rivalries are there for a reason, and it's biblical in nature. So this directly contradicts the claim that certain inhabitants, particularly Jewish inhabitants of Israel, have no ancestral claim to the land. It contradicts it when you look at their DNA and when you come to understand that reading the biblical narrative, this was given to them. But at the same time, there's no evidence suggesting that modern Palestinians are direct descendants of either the Canaanites or Philistines of the Old Testament, because that wouldn't be true, because they weren't of that lineage. So that they can't make that claim. Many Arabs are descendants of Ishmael. But since the land of Canaan was promised to the sons of Jacob, Arabs have no biblical claim to the land of Palestine. So this is from an article on gotquestions.org or biblestudy.org. So the reason that the term Palestine is used now is because the Romans tried to remove the emotional attachment that the Jews had to this land. They didn't see that as positive for the Roman Empire because they were so vehement about fighting for it. And so they wanted to separate them. They removed them from the land. They tried to rename it. They tried to rename Jerusalem, Aelia Capitolina, and just change the whole dynamics of the land. So the Jews say, and our guide said, who was Jewish, and by the way, the guides were impressive, and all of them were very well educated. There were four buses, and each had their own guide. And so they all had their own take and their own personality and their own way of approaching the history and the biblical narratives. But our guide had two master's degrees. He studied at the Hebrew University right there in Jerusalem for 7 years. And now he's been a guide for 20 years and had depth as a Jewish man and also by education and by experience. So his perspective was very valuable to us. And he said that this all was an attempt by the Roman Empire to disconnect the Jews from their homeland. So the Muslims conquered Jerusalem and this area in 634 AD. And then in 691, they built the Dome of the Rock. And so they've had control of the Temple Mount since then. And there was a series of different empires that came through. The Crusaders came by, Mongols came through, and then the Ottomans had control, the Turkish Ottomans had control of this area for 400 years. Until World War I, when it shook up the Ottoman Empire, and the British came in and said, we'll take this area. And they marched the Turks out, and they took on the area that is Israel. And they did that until 1947, when they said, we're ready to hand this back. We don't need to have control of this area. So in 1947, the British announced its desire to terminate this mandate that they had taken on to control the area. And the UN, United Nations General Assembly, adopted a resolution to partition the state into multiple areas. A Jewish state, a Palestinian state, and then a international zone, which would be the city of Jerusalem. So this is where we start to hear of a two-state solution. Two-state solution. Anybody ever heard of that? Anybody ever wonder what that meant? So a two-state solution would be where the Israelites... Okay, well, here's the 1947 proposed two-state solution. This has better contrast so you can see it. So in 1947, this was the solution. So the areas in Aqua would be proposed Israel, and then the area that's largely referred to as the West Bank, a part in northwest Israel, and then the area that's now the Gaza Strip, and a whole lot more would have been given to the Palestinians, the Arabs. So they rejected this. The Palestinians said, no, this doesn't work for us. We want all of the land. And our guide said that they have a saying in Hebrew that says, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Because every time a solution is proposed, they reject it, and then what they end up getting is way worse and way less for them. So this was the map, and then these boundaries were established, and then later in later wars, the 1967 war in particular, Israel took over all of this territory, and they control it all now. And these are these areas that are now shrunk down and more like this slide here are called Israel-occupied territories. So up in the Golan Heights, which is up in this region here around Sea of Galilee, that's considered Israel, but only by two nations, Israel and the United States. Everyone else has territorial disputes. And there are lines that are drawn here, and that was their pre-1967 lines. So there's the pre-1967 line, there's the current line, and then there's an area controlled by the United Nations. We actually drove a bus up to a lookout right up here where that little land jut is. And we had lunch. So where we're having lunch, you can see Lebanon right there. And then we drove to this lookout, and you could see where the former Lebanese and Syrian military bunkers and establishments were. And you could see that those had been taken out. And then where the current lines were, there were military establishments from Israel. And then there was the UN blue line, they call it. And you could see these white land cruisers that were United Nations, and they had tents and things out there in the no man's land. And then beyond that, you could see Lebanon. And then from a different lookout, you could see Syria. And The estimate is that between all of these surrounding nations, there are 200,000 missiles aimed at Israel. And so, does anybody remember the number of Israels that were fired last Sabbath morning? 5,000. Five of 200,000. It's estimated that Hamas has control of 20,000, now presumably 15,000 after they fired 5,000 of them. But they, if they were all to fire at the same time, that would be a serious problem. We could see how the tension is building. We could feel it even. And there's a feeling that, you know, so we're talking about this on the bus throughout the week, and then on Sabbath morning we saw it literally come to fruition. Okay, so there's this 1967. You can look up the Six-Day War. What happened is, it's called a Six-Day War, but it was really about a 90-minute war. Because what Israel did was they went and took out the air forces of their surrounding nations. They went and preemptively bombed their air force and their airstrips. And so they could not get a plane in the air. And then over the next 6 days, they redrew the boundaries and then occupied those territories. So who is Hamas? Hamas is a word in Arabic that, sorry, sometimes this happens when I touch this thing, it just goes black. Hamas is a word in Arabic that means zeal, strength, and bravery. Interestingly, there's a very similar word in Hebrew that means violence. And so they both play on this, these different terms. How in one way it means zeal, strength, and bravery, in the other way it means violence. It's actually an acronym of an Arabic phrase meaning Islamic Resistant Movement. So again, you see how these terms, Arabic, Palestinian, and now Islam, are all being stitched together. It's this religious, ethnicity, pride, and genetic combination. And they use them all very much interchangeably. So the headquarters for Hamas is in the West Bank. In Gaza City, with operations also in the West Bank. So in 2017, the Hamas Charter presented the Palestinian state as saying they want the pre-1967 borders. And the Hamas considers the establishment of a Palestinian state sovereign and complete on the basis of the boundaries as of June 4th, 1967, with Jerusalem as its capital and the provision for all refugees to return to their homeland. So what they want is to be able to return to their homeland. So a rough analogy that we can all use and understand is that this area of the Gaza Strip is a very small piece of land with 2 million Palestinians stuffed into it. Think of it not dissimilar to a reservation. So when America took over North America, they took those that were living there, the indigenous peoples, and gave them reservations to live on. It's not terribly dissimilar to that. It's a lot more concentrated, but what Israel did is they came and occupied all of these areas. They came and occupied Tel Aviv, which was Joppa. You remember where Jonah tried to escape and head off somewhere else and got sent back up, swallowed by a fish? That was, I'm not exactly sure. Tel Aviv is somewhere right in here, I think. And so these people are living and in these cramped quarters, and they just want to be able to go back. Well, all of those that got displaced are pretty much dead. So they want their subsequent generations to be able to go back. And Israel's saying, this is our land. We're not giving it back. And their secret weapon, the Israeli secret weapon, this is what they will say when it comes to fighting for this territory, and we'll be able to talk more about this when we talk about Masada and the lessons they learned there, is this. They have nowhere else to go. If the Jews lose this as their homeland, there's nowhere else they can go. They've already been dispersed around the world and they were persecuted there. So they've come back from where those that occupy this space anyway have come back. They maintain their identity wherever they got dispersed to, Eastern Europe and all over the world. And we know that there are Jewish communities here and in LA and in New York and Miami are big settlements of Jewish population. And those that have gone back have nowhere else to go. And so they will fight tenaciously to the death. And so this is what the environment is like here. Now, the Hamas have been barbaric in their tactics. Since the mid-1990s, Hamas has gained popularity and support in Palestinian society, drawing support for their perceived lack of corruption and its anti-Israeli stance. They're very openly anti-Israeli. Western countries and their allies have designated Hamas as a terrorist organization, citing the militants. That's the term, militants. Some prefer militants, some prefer terrorists. But here's where the nuance comes in. They would be militants, but they also use human shields, hostage taking of civilians, and a history of violence against non-combatants, including massacres of civilian populations, suicide bombings, and indiscriminate rocket attacks on Israeli population centers. However, a 2018 attempt to condemn Hamas for acts of terror at the United Nations failed. So there's a lot of sympathy for the Palestinian plight. And you've seen that, and it's maybe confusing and hard to understand. But if you look at it from their perspective and hear their narrative, they occupied these lands and suddenly they were ousted and shoved into these cramped quarters and said, sorry, you lost your house, you lost your territory. And they say, well, what do we do to deserve that? There isn't a great answer for that. No different than when Joshua marched the nation of Israel into the land and God said, take it. Take it from who's there. And we have to go back to Genesis to understand why these things are true. And they believe that in that narrative, but they believe that the birthright was given to Ishmael and Esau. And that would make sense because those are the firstborn. So you can see how from their mindset they can rationalize this, just as Israel says you need to go. And Israel was authorized to kill the inhabitants and instructed to in many cases. We remember where Saul lost his kingdom because he didn't completely destroy the Amalekites. And so God said to use these tactics. And so they're both praying to God for their success. And so it really is a challenge to get a feel for this and to really understand all that's going. It was something that we studied the whole time, and there's what I hope you can see here is that there's a lot of information that you can get on YouTube and you can come to understand it currently, but we really want to understand this through the biblical lens. So this proposed two-state solution is one that neither party really wants because they both want it all. So again, we see these surrounding areas. So let's finish with a couple more scriptures. So the Wall Street Journal has had multiple articles on this subject this week. And one thing it says to do, one thing that the Wall Street Journal suggests is that while we focus on the Hamas, while we focus on the current conflict with Israel, what we really need to do is back up, and as we are here on the map, and have a little broader look at this whole area. And they said, never forget Iran. I did it again. So the laser is this button, and the slide changer is this button, and I confuse them. So Iran right here is a massive area of territory, and Iran is Persia. So Iranians often will refer to themselves as Persian. So it's only been since 1935 that this area has even been referred to as Iran. And so we remember the Persian Empire. We remember Cyrus. We just talked about this, how Cyrus, when he consolidated the Medes, the territory of the Medes and the Persians, and the Persian Empire was established in the first month of the first year. He did God's will and allowed the Jews to return to Israel. So this relationship between Persia and Israel has been an important one for some time. Let's turn to Daniel and let's recognize something that we read and we can better understand as we read in the words of the Bible, that there is a spiritual element to all that is taking place. And if we can understand that, then we can better contextualize these events with regard to biblical prophecies. So when we think about Persia, we know what Cyrus did and how God inspired that. And then we can go back to Daniel. And as we were reading about Daniel, Daniel is trying to understand these visions that are coming to him, and he's praying about it. And in chapter 10 of Daniel, verse 1, it says, "In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar." That was Daniel's name, his Persian name. And so as we go down the story, he's praying for some revelation here. And then, verse 10, "Suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palm of my hands." So he's on his hands and knees. "And he said to me, 'O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand aright, for I've been sent to you.' So while he was speaking to me, this word to me, I stood trembling." This is first person Daniel now. "And then this angel said to him, 'Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humble yourself before God, your words were heard. I've come because of your words.'" So Daniel was praying to God, and now this angel was sent to him. But the angel says, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. So for 3 weeks, there was this spiritual stalemate, where the messenger, presumably Gabriel, could not get to Daniel because a demon or demonic force held him in Persia. The prince of Persia. Spirit is eternal. Do you think this prince of Persia still exists? Do you think that that hatred towards the other line still exists? There's a phrase that commentator said, "We can't understand the persistent violence between these two peoples. We just can't suppress it, and it's hard to understand. But through the biblical narrative, we can understand it." So that there's this spiritual influence on this group of people that makes them hate and want to eradicate Israel. And that's going to continue to persist, and it's going to persist until the end time. So as we keep going, "The prince of Persia withheld me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia." Now verse 14, "Now," this is what Gabriel is saying to Daniel, "now I've come to you to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come." So we see that this is the time that was being talked about then. There's always a past, a present, and a future understanding of the scriptures and the prophecies. And these scriptures help us to understand what's going on. Know this: God is orchestrating these events. He's allowing this to happen. And know this, as you know, and you read in the opening letter, events happen fast. These prophecies get fulfilled. It seems like everything's just going along, and then suddenly everything can change, and it happens fast. So, as we were reminded of on the Day of Trumpets, and we can have our attention called to these events, simulev, pay attention.